Lift those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Good morning, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Weekly I try and bring in a person from our community or an organisation or talk about an event. This morning I've got Terry Cook. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Herb.
Well, thanks for coming in. Lovely winter's day.
Yes, a very pleasant day. The ground outside's a bit on the soggy side, though.
That's right, after all this rain. But I feel that we are getting to the end of winter.
Yes.
It'll soon be spring. So thanks for coming in, Terry. Now, you've been in Armidale since 84.
That's correct.
So we're going to call you a local. I always say 15 years.
Only just.
I know, I always say 15 years is local. That's enough for me. Born in Manila.
Yes.
On the banks of the Manila River?
No, actually we're on the banks of the Namoy River.
I do have a connection with Manila. A memory of the bus trip up to Manila and through all the limestone outcrops as you go up.
Yeah, it was a limestone quarry.
In Tunga. You've got those all little outcrops as you go up toward Manila. Split Rock Dam. Was Split Rock Dam built when you were there?
No, it got built after I left Manila.
So, and you went to Farah Agricultural High School as a boarder.
Yes.
In up to 60 to 64.
Yes, yeah, I did.
And what was being a boarder at Farah like?
Look, it gave me a good education. It gave me a very good grounding in mathematics. I went on to become a surveyor.
And you tell me before that you published drawings in The Mile, the school magazine.
Yes, that's right. It was the school magazine, and it was the first of my drawings ever to be published. Nice to see them in the magazine.
You had interest in photography as well?
I was interested in photography, and I was given a Helena 35X 35mm camera. It was just general photography, but I did get into developing and I learned how to develop photos at the same time.
So you developed at school?
No, there was no photography offered at school. This was all done at home.
So that interest in drawing and photography, can we link that back to your uncle John Dixon?
Very much so. John was a comic strip artist, and during the 1940s, he published a whole lot of comics, things like Tim Valor, Crimson Comet, and these are all comics that, you know, he made up himself and drew and published. But what he became quite famous for was Air Hawk and the Flying Doctors, which was published in the Sydney Morning Herald, both the Sunday and the weekly edition. They also got published around the world.
Yes, published around the world. I think it started in Perth, went from 59 to 86, started in Perth, went to all the Australian press outlets, went to the US, went to Britain. So it was very successful, and it became a film called Air Hawk. And Jim Hawk, who was the principal aviator, was Eric Oldfield. It was about the aviator. He was a spy, was he? Or
not a spy. He was just a bit of a hero type guy that they had adventures in the outback. He had a doctor, Matthews, I think it was an offsider, and there was Nurse Janet. And they went around having all sorts of different adventures. One I remember was a lost Egyptian city, which was found in the middle of Australia, and the whole adventure, you know, that particular series was based around that Egyptian city.
Well, I think there's probably people out there still believe it's there. That's the power of the press. So that's great. So we'll talk about that, your art and photography, a little bit later, but let's talk about your surveying. So you did a Bachelor of Surveying at University of New South Wales.
I did.
And you had a first exposure with computer programming on IBM 1130. What is an IBM 1130?
One of the very early computers. This actually was a paper tape machine. I don't know whether people remember, probably most people don't remember what paper tape was. Similar machines at the time used to use cards. It's where I wrote my first Fortran program on the IBM 1130, but the 1130, we were using it to do surveying and engineering calculations. We actually set up a bureau, and I was working in that bureau for a couple of years.
So interestingly, when I came to uni here, there was a whole room dedicated to a computer called Gera, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it was a punch card.
Yes.
Punch card, that's right.
Yep.
That was, and it was a GIS unit that I was doing, land spatial something or other.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had to do that once. So you just did it once. So it was old tech, just to get you a bit of a flavour of the old tech
mm-hmm.
on the Gera. It's probably been...
No, Gera, I think Gera, Barney, they actually named a lot of the computers at the university after the streets and rivers around Armidale. So Gera's right.
Yep. Well, that's what I remember from my... at least I got something from my GIS.
And they were punch cards with, and they had massive big hard disks on them that, probably took, 20 megabytes or something like that, ridiculously small by today's standards.
And then you got married and lived in Perth, working as a land surveyor on remote locations, Pilbara, the goldfields. Tell me about working in remote areas.
Interesting. In WA, the company I worked for, we had offices in Port Hedland, Karratha and in Darwin. And we did work for a lot of the mining companies, worked out in the Hamersley Ranges doing trigonometrical surveys, worked in Port Hedland where I surveyed there's a 15-kilometre shipping channel which the big iron ore carriers come in through, did siltation studies on the shipping channel because they were worried about the cyclones up there dumping silt into the channel. Basically, we were driving four-wheel drives, we had things like kerosene-powered freezers that we used to take out in the bush and camp out there for weeks on end. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience.
So obviously you're pretty busy, but I note here that you and your wife won the 6KY Sunday Times Safety Drive winning a Honda Civic. What was that about?
When I was in Sydney, I did two safety drives, and these are... You drive for 2 or 3 hours around the city, and they have observers, basically, to make sure you're following the road rules. And the two I did in Sydney, I did abysmal. I just didn't quite know how to do it, but I did learn how to do a safety drive. So when we're in Perth, it was about a year or so after we were there, my wife was reading the Sunday paper and said, "Oh, there's a safety drive on. We want to go in it." And I said, "Oh, maybe." And anyway, we decided to go in it. And I did know the ropes. I knew I had to read the rule book backwards. I had to follow all the rules, which I did. And this went for 2 or 3 hours around Perth. We got back to the finish and we got a call eventually saying, "Please come up to the main office." And two of us tied for first. And the first prize was a Honda Civic. The second prize was a motorbike. And so they gave us 10 road rules that we had to answer the questions from, and I won that one. So that's how I got the Honda Civic.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Free car.
Free car, good. Absolutely. For 3 hours just, work, it was good.
Yeah, just have to use your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, you probably didn't do much in terms of creativeness out in the Pilbara, but as a result of those trig surveys, you did an out remote areas, you did publish a photo.
Yeah.
Called Trig Survey in the Pilbara. Where was that published?
That was actually an advertising brochure which was used to promote the firm that I was working for at the time. And the photo was taken on a big trig survey in the Hamersley Ranges where we were basically measuring over 30, 40 kilometres between trig points.
Nice. And thankfully for us, you came to Armidale in 84, working at UNE in IT and GIS. Till 2008. Now tell us about that role.
Start with, I worked for the Geography and Planning Department. My job was to support the GIS and the satellite imagery part of it. Eventually, as the finances tightened up a bit and things changed at the university, I moved down to the central IT area, where I became a manager for a while. And then I moved up to the facilities management, set up a GIS, a geographic information system, for the campus.
Yes, I do remember you wandering around the Geography Planning Department.
Yes, yeah. It's a nice department to work for.
It was good staff there at the time.
Yeah, still in contact with many of them, so, yeah.
Now, 2003, while you're working, the first digital camera.
Yes.
So that was a bit of a... to all of us who had film cameras, the digital camera was this new beast, and you didn't have to worry about whether the photos are any good. You could just take a stack of them and put them on the card. Now, tell me about that first camera.
It actually was a gift. My brother-in-law lives in Newfoundland in Canada, and he ran a successful, would you believe, refrigeration company. And he was given this camera free, and he didn't want to use it, so he gave it to me. So once I got the hang of, you know, I can take as many photos as I like and just experiment and what have you, I was absolutely rapt, and, you know, then led me to go on and buy a decent, my first cameras were Sony's. And yeah, I was just so impressed with it, and the ability to process your own photos and, you know, touch them up if you had to. Yeah, I was hooked.
Well, I think just the camera, and I was talking to the Armidale Folk Museum about, and they've got supposedly quite a lot of cameras in their collection.
Oh, right.
So cameras do have a connection with people way back, you know, because everybody had a camera. When you even a box brownie, all the Agfa roll, you know, fold out cameras. Everybody had a camera, and it sort of captured moments in a family's life, like the birth of a new child, bringing home, christenings, weddings. So they do have a very strong connection, the camera, with our society, and I think they do serve a very important role. Then you think about moving from the film camera to the digital camera and how much power that has, and look at our internet now, Pinterest, all the platforms, that Spotify, you know, the cameras mm-hmm. that are in your phone are so powerful and so great comparison to what they were back then.
Yeah.
So they've gone a long way, but they've been with us. The camera, the taking of, it's almost a part of our DNA now, I think. The taking of a photo is just synonymous with the human existence, I think.
It is, though. I do worry a bit about how transient it can be in terms of people keeping, you know, the photographs they're taking for, you know, the next generation to, you know, see what their lives were like. And, yes, make sure they get circulated and somebody will keep them into the future.
Yes. The other thing that worries me is the size of the megabytes that it takes for a photo.
Yes, but the reverse of that is if you're on WhatsApp, which a lot of, you know, family photos get taken on, basically they're only very small files. So if somebody wants to do a nice print to put up on the wall, a WhatsApp image is not good enough.
Right, so WhatsApp, so we're learning a bit here, I'm learning something. So WhatsApp's good for taking photos and sharing them, but you can't...
They're all reduced to 300, you know, like your first photos you took, you know, 300 kilobytes or so.
Right.
Yeah, they're quite small.
So then you just revert, if you were taking something for a canvas or a larger printout, you'd use
your phone camera and it would record the big image. But if you put it into WhatsApp, WhatsApp will reduce it down to, you know, 200 or 300 kilobytes.
All right, so you've actually captured it already with your camera. I'm just trying to work out how that works. So the camera has captured it. You've stored it, so you've got that as a high quality image, and you're just converting it into WhatsApp to move it away.
You can do it that way, but I think you can also photograph directly with WhatsApp, and I suspect it will just create a small image.
Gotcha. Yes, we're learning bits about photography now. We're a little bit off track, but you were there until 2008 at the UNE, then you retired. You did a little bit at TAFE.
Yes, I did a graphic design course for a while at TAFE. It's where I got some exposure to graphic design and to using things like Photoshop and Illustrator. And it also triggered the idea in my mind that I could combine my drawing with photography. So using something like Photoshop, you can put the two together. And if you look at most of my artwork these days, that's how it's created.
So speaking of your artwork, you've done a few books, Contrast and Colour. You've done, that was in 2014, 2017, 40 Photographers, 2019, Images with Altitude, 2020, Seasons, and 2022, Mount Juval.
Mm-hmm.
So were they all coffee table books, essentially?
Well, they weren't hardcover, they were softcover, but they've proved quite popular. The reason for doing them was there simply wasn't anything around in Armidale for people to send to friends, relatives, you know, overseas or around Australia to show off Armidale. So effectively that was the reason for putting them together. I crowdfunded several of those books, and there's probably 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 of them floating around the world somewhere now. So they've been quite popular.
Were they only produced as books? Were they a digital online or just
no,
books?
I've only produced them as books, yep.
Images of Altitude, tell me what that one was.
Okay, that was the university. Annabel Duncan, when she was Vice-Chancellor, she asked me to produce a book of the university. So I actually photographed the university and the various centres in the different country towns and put a book together, and that was the name of the book, Images with Altitude, New University of New England.
Because I was thinking about what you've done more recently with drone imagery.
Mm-hmm.
You've been out to the Gwydir Wetlands, you've done a lot of river trips, photographing the rivers, the floods, all that type of thing. Tell me about that experience and now a different technology, still taking photos, but the different technology of using drones. What's that like?
Yeah, that was interesting because I got asked by a government department to photograph, go out and photograph the Western rivers. First of all, I did it with conventional cameras and I was a bit disappointed because the flat country, particularly around Moree and that, it was very hard to get a sense of what was going on. So I got myself a drone and it just was chalk and cheese. Once you put the drone up, you know, 100 metres or whatever, and just looked at the landscape, you got a completely different perspective. I do a bit of both. I'll do just camera on land and also do the drone photography, but it just gives a much better perspective of, you know, how everything fits together and, you know, how the rivers look and what have you. Yep.
Well, I agree totally with what you say, because when you came out to the Gingham Watercourse and took those drone footage of some of the works that we'd done in the watercourse, some crossings and where the water was actually being held up the way we wanted it to, it was chalk and cheese. It showed us really what was going on.
Yep.
So it was a great addition to managing the landscape. You tell me that 2019 you did feel a little bit frustrated with photography and you went back to drawing.
Well, I didn't so much go back to it, but photography is always, I found, to be restrictive because you whatever's in front of you, you're stuck with. Now, a good photographer will use composition and light and colour and all sorts of different things, but you're still stuck with, you know, where the trees are, where the hills are, etc., etc. And I like using my imagination, and drawing allows me to just make up stuff. So some of the drawings I've done basically imagine landscapes, which reflect my feelings, more my feelings of the landscape than what's actually maybe there.
So in 2020, you did, we're talking about lockdown, we're talking about COVID, you did an exhibition called Life in the Time of Lockdown. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, that wasn't my exhibition. That was one that was put on by the Armadale Art Gallery and got all the artists to do some artwork that reflected what their life was like in lockdown. And I thought I'd do a couple of drawings. It was the first time I'd really published or displayed my drawings. And I didn't think much of it at the time, but it actually proved quite popular. And I sold some and I thought, oh, there's something in this. Which then got me to go on and think about doing my own solo exhibitions.
So I might just sort of get you to explain your style of drawing, because you actually incorporate fairly detailed narrative in ink, and just correct if I'm wrong, and then applying colour washes to backgrounds and different things.
If you look at my background, as you know, I've been a cartographer, draftsperson, surveyor, engineer. I quite like detail, and when I draw, I like putting detail into drawings. I like things to be fairly representative, I suppose. And so I generally sketch up in pencil, ink it in, scan it into the computer. Then I go looking, I actually photograph texture. If you go around and look at all sorts of different things, from rocks and sand and soil and leaves and what have you, you can take macro shots and get very interesting textures. And if you look at my drawings, you can see I've incorporated these textures into the drawing, and also some of the colours as well. So the photography often gives me the colours and the texture, and I do the line drawings, you know, in pen and ink.
Interesting you say about in nature, observing nature. One of the things that really got me doing some of the courses through Armadale Art Society, Perrette Ramundi.
I remember that name.
Yes. She was a great teacher as well as a great illustrator and her use of colour. But one of the things we were doing, fungi and lichens.
Oh, wow.
And that, and what blew me away is that just the repetitive patterns that are repeated across and across. You know what I'm talking about?
Actually, you're giving me some ideas here.
We might have to do a combined effort. Nature does have a lot to tell us if we look hard enough and you get close in on, as I said, the lichens or something like that, these repetitive patterns. And you can produce those repetitive patterns in your art form to produce something.
Yeah, and talking about being more observant in lockdown, where I was restricted just to my own garden, it was amazing what I found when I went looking. You know, just close-up stuff with macro and what have you. It was like a wonderful set of photography during that time, which is really just my garden.
There's a world out there. Yeah. We don't have to go too far to find it. You just have to have an open mind.
Mind and a good eye. Yep.
And a good eye. So just tell me about, there was a gallery, theme drawings, 7 billion blind mice. What's that about?
This is me venting my frustrations about where the world's heading in terms of environmental degradation, I suppose. So it was a whole series of drawings, basically was illustrating what, you know, we as humans are doing to the world. It actually proved to be quite popular, and I actually sold quite a few of them, which I was a little bit surprised at, because some of them were fairly hard-hitting in terms of, you know, having a go at, you know, the sorts of things we're doing to the environment.
Well, I think that's the thing about art, is that it has a way to engage with people on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. Instead of people writing reports about global warming and land clearing and loss of native vegetation and threatened species, and those reports tend to just languish on bookshelves or in hard drives. Mm-hmm. But if you can actually bring that story out onto the art stage, then you actually have a different set of eyes or ears looking at that, and they maybe could be policymakers or could be influencing other policymakers and government departments to actually get off their hands and do something.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember one of the drawings was showed a big jumbo jet basically full of people and basically all the exhaust fumes killing off trees and what have you. And a friend of mine looking at it, and she's got children who live in Europe, and she said, "Terry, I get your message, but I still want to see my grandchildren in Europe."
Well, that's the carbon footprint, I suppose. She could offset it by investing in a few trees somewhere in Central America or something. Mm. And they're drawing the line. It was another exhibition?
Yes, that was Imagine Landscapes. I've lived here for long enough. I'm a bushwalker. I'm a landscape photographer. You know, I know the gorge country. I've orienteered through, you know, most of the bushland around here. So I know the place pretty well backwards. And it was drawings, really, of my impressions of the landscape, not necessarily realistic ones. And that was very popular.
Fantastic. Well, you've done a lot of stuff. So what have you got happening now?
Okay.
Something's coming up on September, 20th. I want to say
20th. 20th. A little bit of background to this. I actually had an unfortunate immune disease 18 months ago, and it really knocked me around quite a lot. And I completely lost interest in drawing and photography, for that matter. Anyway, I decided I'd put myself down for an exhibition, which was due on the 20th September. It will happen on the 20th September. And I was racking my brains for a topic. And then I thought back to 2019. Now, I don't know whether you remember what 2019 was like, but not everybody does. If you talk to somebody who's on the land, they'll say, yes, it was horrendous. You know, the drought, the fires, the smoke, the dust, et cetera, et cetera. You talk to city folk and generally you get, 2019, water restrictions, and, you know, I don't really feel it too much. Anyway, so I'm doing a series of drawings and photos. I photographed that whole year. It was a terrible year. And so this exhibition's going to be an exhibition of photography and drawings, reflecting, you know, what that year was like.
Well, I certainly remember what 2019 was, both in from what we were doing as community radio station, the bushfire smoke alerts over the town and health problems that that was causing, and also the water restrictions and where water outlets were that council were allowing people to get outlets. Yeah. But I also remember out west, working out west on the western floodplain, and how dry and trying to keep wetlands and watercourses going in that dry period to try and keep habitat going. So, yes, so it's going to be a great exhibition. Now, that's at the Armidale Art Gallery, the New England Art Society's gallery.
In the mall.
In the mall.
Yep.
Just two doors up or one door up from the...
Next to the newsagent.
Newsagent. Mm-hmm. And that'll be... what time will that be?
Oh, look, you'd have to double check. I think the opening will be at 2 o'clock and it runs for about 1 month.
1 month. So we'll be promoting that. We are actually promoting that now on our radio station. But get along to Terry's exhibition on the 20th of September at the Armidale Art Gallery. So I think we might pull it up. Autoimmune disease you talk about. I've been trying to get you in for a while to talk to you. That has been a problem. But I'm glad to hear that it's actually lesser of a problem now.
It's less of a problem. I'm in remission. This will hang around for the rest of my life, and they're treating it by just suppressing my immune system.
And at the same time, you've got a 99-year-old mother in Tamworth that you're looking for.
Yes. I spend 3 days a week with her at the moment. Look, she'll turn 100 on the 31st of the 12th, still living at home. So, you know, she's doing pretty well.
Well, that's something to be said.
Yeah.
Not many like that. Well, Terry, look, thanks for coming in. You're a gem in our community. Wish you all the best fortune with your upcoming exhibition and exhibitions to come. And I hope your condition doesn't impact what you might do in the future.
So do I.
So thank you again for coming in, Terry, to Community Spotlight. And that is Community Spotlight. Thank you.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.